I'm not sure a daily act of rebellion's necessary when your whole life is a protest.
You're listening to a Wheels on the Ground production.
Rick, welcome to A.G. Parker's Cabinet of Curiosities. You are the first guest on this podcast, so thank you so much for popping my cherry. Would you like to tell our audience a little bit about...
Thank you.
Thank you. Sorry, we do have a delay, so I'm just going to remember to pause in between speaking. Do you want to tell our audience a little bit about who you are and what you do?
Well, I am a poet and live storyteller. I've been doing it since about 2015. Always wrote poetry and then sort of took a break when sort of life took over, and then went back to sort of writing and performing in 2015. I take part in quite a few poetry slams. I'm the current UK poetry slam champion with Hammer and Tongue. And yeah, just write and perform as much as I can.
Amazing. I really wanted to do a loud like cheer then when you said you're the Hammer and Tongue National Slam Champion, but I thought if there's a delay, I'm just going to interrupt you with a word. Awesome. So you took a bit of a break because life got in the way. How are you finding your creative process during the pandemic? Has it been affected?
I think it's been interesting because like quite a lot of my creative process was around live performance and a little bit of background. I have a autoimmune condition which is managed with immunosuppressants. So when the pandemic started, I was sort of going from performing like 3 or 4 times a month to being shut in a house and not being able to leave or see anyone. So it changed everything, really. And so started looking more at the work and working in different mediums and seeing what we could do with that, because live performance and sort of mixing with people was off the agenda for the foreseeable future. And it's only just now with the vaccines and stuff like that that things can start getting back to normal. But it's still quite a challenge to be out there and doing that sort of thing when you're supposed to be at home.
Yeah, and especially in a pandemic where disabled people or anyone who's got any kind of clinical vulnerability, where we're kind of being told that our lives maybe don't matter quite as much as our non-disabled friends. So mentally, is that taking a bit of a toll? Is that affecting your work? Or are you finding that you're able to kind of overcome that?
I think it's making an appearance in some of my work, in that, you know, it's that thing that if it's on your mind, it comes out through your words, even if you don't intend it to. So that feeling of going from being someone who had sort of well-managed condition and all that sort of thing, never really thought of myself as sort of chronically ill or even disabled, even though conditions on the exemption list for prescriptions and all that sort of thing. I went from that to having conversations with people on social media and sort of Zoom chats and things like that, where they were literally arguing for putting all the vulnerable people into a camp somewhere so everyone else could get on with their lives, you know. So you went from being sort of happy-go-lucky to sort of, okay, people I've known for years would want to put me in a concentration camp. That's interesting. So yeah, it did change.
Yeah, that's that's a pretty serious reality to be confronted with, that somebody feels that way.
And a bit of a shock, but then when you see the sort of the full spectrum of how people have dealt with the pandemic in general, like public and, you know, people that are refuseniks about mask wearing or vaccines or even social distancing and sort of have wildcat parties and all that sort of thing. When you see the different ways that lots of different people have approached it, you can't be surprised about the thinking behind it when you can see the actions in front of you. So it's kind of, I think it was more, not so much of a wake-up call as a sort of removing of a net curtain. You can actually see what's going on now, rather than people being hidden about it. It's quite obvious who thinks more of themselves than everybody else. You can see it in their behaviour. So.
Absolutely, absolutely. It's it's terrifying in some ways, but you're definitely getting a good insight into the breadth and depth of humanity as a whole, which is fascinating. So because you've moved from doing largely in-person performances to doing things over Zoom and online events, are you finding that your creative avenues are expanding, that you're finding different ways of engaging your audience? Because I know that previously you said you love trying to win round an audience in person. So has that changed?
Yes, it has. And I think it's kind of changed in the way that I approach any particular piece now, because if you're working to a different media, then you kind of, there's certain things that work better in person. You can really sell a line with a look when you're in person. You can't do that when it's on the page. So you have to adapt the work to the medium that you're working in. I think that has been a really interesting challenge. And I think actually in the end, it will inform everything that I do, and it will be, you know, hopefully something that I can take forward and develop and improve all of my writing. But it's that thing of working in different media gives you different skills, and I've really enjoyed being able to develop those. So
absolutely, yeah, stretching your creative muscles. And are you still focusing on social justice with your work and with your art?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I think there is, if anything, the pandemic has brought into sharp focus that the world is definitely a turtle on its back, to flip the Terry Pratchett thing. And we all have a role to play in flipping it over. I think, you know, some people will have a lever that they can pull around, let's say, disabled rights. Somebody has a lever they can pull around climate change. Somebody has a lever they can pull around racial justice. And everybody has to work their own lever and flip the turtle over. I think that's an important thing for us all to do right now, because, you know, it's not going to get any better unless we do something about it.
And historically, it has been shocking. I wrote an essay once about disability representation in art and literature, and I included the quote, "If in the first act you see a disabled person, by the end they must be cured or dead," which is a bit of a take on Chekhov's gun, because that's the kind of narrative that we were getting sold. You have to be cured or you die as a disabled person, which unfortunately has ramifications in the real world, which we are seeing terrifyingly now. Do you think it's moving in the right direction? Are we going, you know, towards a space where people are going to have a bit more understanding of disabled people, and that, you know, we are equals? Shocking.
I think yes. I think so. I think it's that thing of everything requires a critical mass, and certain things add to the momentum. And there's been a lot of things which have added to the momentum, which makes me feel as if there is a change coming. There is a hell of a lot more visibility of disabled people in mainstream media. One of my favorite shows in the entire world is Last Leg on Channel 4.
Oh, yes.
And that kind of thing, just, it's there. The momentum is moving. It's shifting. And I think hopefully so.
Absolutely. And the Last Leg are fantastic. They have been fantastic, just for being able to turn on my TV and see, you know, two guys with disabilities, having Rosie Jones go to the Paralympics as well, seeing her. It really offered me so much comfort in a time where people were saying, well, you know, as you say, why should I wear a mask? Why do we need restrictions? Put disabled people somewhere else and they could just get on with it. So it's definitely offering a lot of comfort. And yeah, the range of representation as well. So it's moved beyond just disabled people. Is, you know, a typical disabled person is someone in a wheelchair, and we're starting to get more of an understanding and more representation. And I know you're passionate about championing people with invisible disabilities as well. So again, do you think that's something that we're seeing more understanding of?
I think it is something which, as everybody, as we return to normal after the pandemic, and there will be lots of people now who will have, unfortunately, will be having bad reactions from COVID for many, many months and years to come. And I think that kind of shift, together with everything else, I think is something which will change thinking. It will, because, like I say, there's a critical mass that's been reached, and invisible disabilities are one of those things where, you know, I got one of those blue badges for traveling around on the tube that says, please offer me a seat, because myasthenia will flare up. And I've been able to have a fantastic week at work and then, you know, commuting, all that sort of thing, and then be going out to see my friends and be standing at a bus stop for 15 minutes and then fall on the floor. And that kind of thing always catches you out. The first time it happens, it's a trauma, but every time after that, it's fine. But it does catch you out. And sometimes getting to get people to understand that sometimes somebody that looks fit and healthy might actually need your help. Physically is quite a difficult thing to explain. People get really quite affronted if you ask them for help and you look physically capable of, you know, running half marathons, which I can do when I'm feeling good.
You've got the variability of your physical capabilities as well, which I think always really confuses people.
Yeah, I think, I've got better. I've got much, much better at spotting when things are slowing down and stuff. But it's very difficult to explain to people that there are times that you just can't do things. It's like, yeah, I would love to come to the pub, but you know, today I'm struggling to get out of the house. It's. And that's quite difficult for your mental health as well, the variability of it, because you can have 300 good days in a row, but then a bad day can be really bad.
And you can't plan. You can't say, I will definitely be at this gig. I will definitely be able to come to this event. Because you just, as you say, you just don't know. You can just suddenly have your body misbehave in all sorts of ways.
Yeah, absolutely. But I think, again, people are getting more understanding, and I think it's partly to do with the mental health conversation that's happening a lot, especially in things like sports, is the idea that a sports person may not be able to perform because their head isn't right. And if you can be in that situation, if you can be a top athlete and you're not unable to perform because of a health issue, I think other people will start to realize that health issues can stop any of us. And I think that will help.
Absolutely. And representation across the board, you know, in sports, in the arts, in any kind of media, I think it's really important to see people with varying disabilities. It's fantastic you're speaking out about it. That's brilliant. I know I'm definitely sick of people saying, well, what's wrong with you? What's happened? Because I think they think I look normal, quote unquote. I absolutely hate that. Bring back the sword cane is what I say, you know, and then I can poke people with a sharp point when they ask me questions. Sorry, compassion for my disabled people. Yeah.
I think I'd go for an electric cattle prod as a cane, I think.
Oh, wow. that's taking it up a notch, but I really respect that. So do you, at the moment, do you feel like you have is there a pressure on you to kind of have a pretense of wellness? Or do you think you're kind of able to answer the question, how are you, honestly, if someone asks you, for instance?
I don't think anyone's capable of answering the question, how are you, honestly? I think that's just a British thing. I guess for me, How do you, sorry, I just got caught up in how would you answer how are you if you were to answer it really honestly. I just got caught in this sort of thought process of how could I, when would I ever answer that question honestly? I'm not sure I ever would be able to answer that question honestly.
That's really interesting.
It's very difficult to, like, pain, for example.
Yeah.
Right. There was that thing about Wittgenstein and the beetle in the box. It's a thought experiment about beetle in the box. If you gave everybody a box and you told them that there was a beetle in the box, but they were never allowed to open the box, but everybody knew that they had a beetle in the box, what was in everybody's box could be different.
Mm-hmm.
But they would always say there was a beetle in the box. And I think somebody could have a marble, somebody could have a lighter, but they'd all think it was a beetle because they wouldn't have to open it. And I think that's the same with pain, actually. I think that's the same with, especially when you're talking about chronic pain and people get attenuated to it, people get sensitive to it, people learn to live with it. You say, I'm in pain, and somebody's experience of pain will mean that they're beetle in the box pain is one thing. They only have a frame of reference for what pain is or what they've experienced. So
you're...
If my hands get too cold, my fingers stop working.
Yeah.
And they will stop working for half an hour after the rest of my body has warmed up. The nerves just won't come back. And won't be able to open the bottle of drink or, you know, anything. Just it's useless fingers. And trying to explain that to somebody on a day that was happening would be next to impossible unless they'd experienced it. And so you can't answer the question honestly, really, because there's no way of conveying what it is unless you're speaking to somebody who's experienced something similar.
And the fact is, we'll never know because we'll never be able to experience what someone else is experiencing. That's really interesting. So is your hesitance to answer that? I love that I'm focused on this one question. Like, it's really important. Probably not really important, but I'm finding it really intriguing. Your hesitance to answer that question honestly when someone asks you, how are you, comes from them finding it impossible to actually understand what it is you're going through. Is it not enough for you to just say, I'm tired, I'm in pain, my shoulder's dislocating? Sorry, that was that was me. That's how I feel.
I hear you. Yeah, I think so. I think there is a hesitance because I don't want to be misunderstood, I think. And I don't want to, if I'm going to take the tone to somewhere that they're, you know, brutal honesty, then, you know, it would be nice if the brutal honesty was understood. If it's not going to be understood, what's the point?
You know, so then if we translate that to your poetry, for instance, you're trying to communicate your experience. So how is that different?
I think there is also the thing that when you're telling a story or there's narrative in a poem or any kind of message in something that you're saying, there is that thing of when you're writing, you give people the enjoyment of the journey as much as anything else. They don't necessarily need to get, you know, don't need to understand the destination. And I think quite a lot of what I do is, I like assonance and rhyme and alliteration, and I love taking a familiar phrase and twisting it ever so slightly and all of those sorts of things so that the journey is full of things that people will recognize, even if they don't recognize what I'm saying.
Yeah, and it's your poetry is actually really all-encompassing as well. And I think you've got a poem for us later as well at the end, which I'm really looking forward to hearing. Okay, so moving on to capitalism, seamless subject change. So you talk about how capitalism is an unrealistic system for our future. Now, obviously, this is something that you go into with your poetry. Have you do you think it's the artist's place to imagine better futures and then inspire an audience?
Oh, yeah, I think that is one of the most important jobs of the artist, is to think about better futures and to inspire people to chase after them. I think, you know, I think it was Neil Gaiman. And I'm going to bastardize the quote. So maybe if you're listening, Neil, I'm sorry.
I would love Neil Gaiman to listen to my little podcast. Oh, my God.
Along the lines of, we don't tell children stories about dragons to scare them. We teach them stories about dragons to show them that monsters can be killed.
Yeah.
And I think that's completely bastardized. That's so not right. Anyway,
I think it's really close.
And I think that is the role of the artist, in especially a protest. If you're going to be political and you're going to write protest poems or stories or songs or what have you, it, part of your job is the hope side of it. Part of your job is the inspiration. I think I got to a certain age and realize that I'm probably not going to be the person storming the barricades and leading the revolution from the front. I'm probably a little bit too old for that now these days, but I might inspire the person who does it. So maybe that should be what I should settle into. And I got quite comfortable with that idea, actually. The idea that we go out, we create the idea in somebody's head that the world can be a better place.
That's a beautiful notion. So I'm going to bastardize a quote back so that you feel comforted. So one of my favorite quotes is by the revolutionary writer Ursula Le Guin. And she said something along the lines of, hard times are coming when we will be wanting the voices of writers who can see alternatives to how we live and can see through our fear-stricken society to other ways of being and even imagine some real grounds for hope. So I think that's exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah, absolutely. Spot on. Yeah, that's the one. Yeah.
That's wonderful. And so particularly during the pandemic, we've seen people abandoned by our government and forced to choose between putting themselves at risk for work and losing their career and income. But even before that, the insidious capitalist nature of this industry cultivates an unhealthy work pattern for many of us. How do you think capitalism affects the arts? And are we seeing more cynical popularity and like-driven art than ever before?
I don't know whether we're seeing so much cynicism as maybe less risk-taking as everything contracts, the pressures of the market and all of that sort of thing. Over the pandemic, one thing I noticed was that people that were getting booked for literary festivals, etc., stopped being the emerging artists and started being the guaranteed draws.
Okay.
And that kind of thing it narrowed the opportunities for people that were coming up, because, you know, people wanted to play safe with the person who they were booking, because the risk was that people wouldn't come because of the pandemic. So they wanted to make sure they could sell as many tickets as they could. And I think that kind of pressure will happen to the market because there are fewer spaces, there's less money, all of that sort of thing. And in that, those people who are marginalized already get completely squeezed out. And I think that's something which you all have to be wary of. But on the other side of things, and I think this is where we're going back to, I was saying, I think we've reached critical mass, and then you get to a point where things just change because they have to. What was really interesting is all those adaptations that disabled people have been asking for to support them in the cap, you know, support them at work and all those sort of things that we were told were impossible, that we were told were too expensive, that we were told were too hard to work, that they would require too much admin, all of those sorts of things. all the excuses for not putting in those adaptations. All of a sudden, when the pandemic arrived, quite a lot of the adaptations came along with them. So we have more video conferencing. We don't have to meet in person so much. There's quite a lot. People have realized that there's quite a lot of things that you can do to improve accessibility that don't cost lots of money, that don't destroy work cultures and all of that sort of thing. And so now that there's going to be a push for everyone to go back to the office and everyone to do that sort of hamster wheel stuff that sort of takes people out, you know, excludes quite a lot of people. And there will be pressure to go back to that, but there's going to be loads and loads of people who have found benefits from their work-life balance, etc., that just were, hang on a minute, that was quite good. We should keep that. And hybrid events is one thing which I think is going to stick. People are going to do more hybrid events in the arts, and that's going to improve accessibility no end.
Absolutely. I absolutely adore hybrid events, and I hope that they're here to stay. I think there was that flicker of doubt when lockdown eased last year sometime. I've kind of lost track of time and lockdowns, and suddenly online events were getting cut back. Hybrid events were becoming just in person again. And I kind of had this fear of, oh no, we're being left behind. But I think possibly now people have seen the benefit. Hopefully that's something that we see well into the future. It can feel a little bit bleak. So how do you keep the fear at bay? Because I see you posting quotes about writing on Twitter, which is, I mean, they're wonderful, and it definitely keeps me going if it's a bit of a hard day. But do you have any small and wonderful daily acts of rebellion?
Daily acts of rebellion. I'm not sure daily acts of rebellion's necessary when your whole life is a protest. You know, just drawing breath as someone who's chronically ill is a bit of a protest.
That is one of the most perfect quotes. Was that written down? Was that planned?
No, I sort of got there. Hopefully, yes, record it, and then I'll write that down at some point. I think my daily act of rebellion, I think, is the, I'll always make time to write something. I will put together different, depending on my day's going, sort of half an hour to an hour, well, I'll always make sure that something gets written.
That's
and just ring fencing that time is good, because it just means that no matter what, something's been written. And I'll have days when I will make sure that you know, that sort of 6 hours, 7 hours, and there are days where you get caught up in something and just forget to do everything else. But yeah, I think my daily act of rebellion is to make sure that there's always something being written. Because that story, whatever the story is going to be of the moment and something which I can go back to.
And it's important as well, I think, to keep emphasizing to yourself, or I found as well, like during the pandemic, I feel like my voice doesn't matter, because the narrative that I'm being told by society is that my voice doesn't matter. And so often when I come to sit down and write, I don't feel like I have anything worth saying. And I have this fear that kind of overshadows everything. So actually, as you say, ring fencing that time, saying, no, I am worth it. I do need to write something. And just accessing that creative voice, that's so important. That is a really good act of rebellion. Brilliant. just got a bit sad there. I'm probably going to cut this bit, but I've really struggled because of the pandemic, just literally being told disabled people don't matter all the time. And then I come and sit down and want to write a poem, and actually all I feel is kind of this overwhelming despair, like, what is the point? And I've stopped wanting to perform some of my poems because I'm afraid of the audience's response, for instance, to like my poem called Casual Eugenics, which is about the pandemic and disabled people. And yeah, it's it feels a little bit scary sometimes.
No, I hear that. I think this is the other thing I try to do is that thing of with the blank page, not try to necessarily go there with something to say. Sometimes let go there with a question. Ask yourself a question and then answer it. I think that's so not necessarily I want to say this. More where did that come from? Like I think one of the things which was really good for me to cope with was to try and put myself in the shoes of people who were feeling different sorts of fear to me, and try and work out, you know, what are they afraid of? And that was something which, yeah, which gave me lots of different ideas. So yeah, sometimes it's going with a question rather than I want to say something.
And approaching the page with curiosity.
Yeah.
That's fantastic. That's like some real kind of Jedi master like mind skill as well there. To have that compassion, to be open enough to say, okay, people, I love the way you phrased it. People have different fears to me. I think that's really wonderful and something that I can only aspire to at the moment. I'm kidding. I have all the compassion in the world, but not this week. Not today, Satan. Not today.
Oh no, we have those days as well. I got into a fight on the bus.
No.
So basically I got onto the bus, got onto the top deck. It's a really good way of traveling around London during the pandemic. If you go onto a bus, top deck, open the windows, you're virtually outside. So you keep your distance and all that sort of thing. It's kind of like, this is a way of doing mass transit, which is actually quite safe. And I opened the window above me as I sat down on a seat on the bus. And a guy who was unmasked, who was sitting about four rows back, got up from his seat, leaned over me and closed the window.
What?
And then went back to his seat. And then I got up and opened the window again and I looked at him and I said, if you're not going to wear a mask, the window's staying open. And yeah, that was fun. But those kind of confrontations, it's just like, so I can't, it's like I say, what was he afraid of? He was, I don't know, there is something he's afraid of and it's clearly not COVID. So,
And then you see that with responses to other things as well, all over the show. Any kind of prejudice, it does usually come from fear.
Indeed.
Yeah, again, it goes back to art doing its little bit. Each of us just have to keep, you know, offering alternatives and bits of hope and representation that hopefully kind of eventually dispels the fear and offers people a different view of things.
Yeah, I think one of the things I like to do is to show people that there are, you know, you don't have to be afraid all the time. Some things aren't fearful. Some things are, but some things aren't. So,
So, my little anecdote is I was at a socially distanced outdoor event and an NHS anaesthetologist, cannot believe I just said that word on my first podcast episode, challenge. And she was telling me that COVID is a hoax, that as long as we keep our vibrations it's totally fine. And I was thinking, this is somebody who, you know, works in the NHS, who is around patients all the time, who is clearly quite educated. Where is this coming from? And I just spent almost, you know, 2 hours chatting with this person, trying to understand where is she coming from? How has she reached this conclusion? And sometimes you can find that and sometimes you can't, but I think it's important to try at least.
It is important to try. I think the thing about the COVID is a hoax thing, it's always, COVID is a hoax. Okay, there's lots of reasons why I find that particularly difficult, possibly at least six very close reasons why I find that very difficult to hear. But but there is that thing of, do you honestly believe that this world and that all the governments in this world, all the businesses in this world are organized enough to hoax the populace about a virus so that they can do what? Make you stay at home and not buy things. It doesn't make any sense. It's totally nonsensical. I think the breakdown of logic is always quite scary, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. But I mean, yeah, as you say, in a world where capitalism rules and no one is that organized to globally come together and plot to have consumers stay at home. I don't know, we have all bought, microphones and lots of joggers and comfy clothing, so maybe it has worked in some ways.
Disney Plus did okay.
Yeah, exactly. There we go. Oh my God, Disney Plus is behind the pandemic. No, don't quote me on that. I do not believe that COVID is a hoax. I believe it is real and terrifying. And I have long COVID, so there we go. Following on from that ridiculous comment, so this is a podcast for artists who come from othered communities. So I sometimes perform as George the Dragon. Why dragon? Because as a non-binary, disabled and pansexual person living in Tory Britain, I often feel like a mythical creature. I chose dragon because it means I can make terrible puns about spitting fire and having the horn. If you were a mythical creature, what would you be and why?
Oh, crikey.
Yeah, that, so we've gone from capitalism to dragons. There we go.
If I was a mythical creature, okay, so I quite like Greek mythology, so I think I'd probably be a satyr.
Amazing. Okay, and why? Just because you like Greek mythology, or
just because I like Greek? I like sort of the idea of writing poems and hanging about in the woods eating mushrooms. That kind of thing. I mean, yeah, I think the woodland creature of some description. So yeah, definitely a satyr.
That's fantastic. I mean, yeah, yeah, I can't disagree with that. That's brilliant.
Yeah, I don't know if it's about goat legs. I'm not sure about, but you know.
I'm sure there's wax available for goats. I mean, be hairy and proud, you know, just embrace it. Right. Sorry, this is fantastic. I love that I'm intending to do this kind of serious, like, inclusive podcast that platforms voices from marginalized communities, and then at the end I'm going to ask everybody, what mythical creature would you be? This could
That's brilliant though. I think that's pretty fun.
Thank you. It could work. It could not. We're going to find out. Moving back onto you. So you're on tour this year, which is exciting and I'm sure possibly a little bit nerve-wracking in terms of pandemic and stuff. Mm-hmm. Do you want to tell our audience what your top venues are, what you're looking forward to?
Okay. So, yeah, going from Bournemouth, Lewis, Newcastle, Leeds, few dates in London, Leicester to start.
Wow.
It's going to be, yeah, I'm looking forward to it. It's going to be fun. I think the going to new places is going to be the best bit, I think. I spent 4 years in the Northeast. I have never been to Leicester. So this will be my first time in my 40 odd years that I've actually been to Leicester. So that'll be quite nice.
This is your big moment. Oh my God. People of Leicester.
Yeah. So yeah, that's going to be great. So yeah, I'm actually going and staying for a bit so I can see a bit of the city the day after. So I think for me, it was really important that I've been performing in London for quite a long time, and stressful though it is to think about sort of commuting and dates which might have to change and all of those sorts of things because of the pandemic, it's the opportunity to take words which I've given to a London audience almost exclusively to other places in the country. I think that's important. And I think, yeah, really looking forward to going about the place. It's going to be good fun.
Excellent. And yeah, I mean, I think the more we get, you know, artists out into different parts of the country, I think the better we're going to see the results.
There's lots of, I mean, the scene is across the country is really strong. And I think one of the great, going back to pandemic adaptations, one of the great things has been that I've got to see and interact with poetic scene across the country over the last couple of years. And that's part of the reason why I'm so excited to go out and do it live now. It's because you could dial in on Zoom to everywhere across the country to see various open mics. And I did that for most of the pandemic, and it's really nice to be able to do that. So I think,
and across the world as well,
pretty good. Oh yeah, across the world. Yeah, performed in New Zealand at an ungodly hour on a Sunday morning, having gone to, that was the thing, yeah, in the middle of the summer when I finally managed to get out of the place because people were having like barbecues and stuff.
Yeah.
My mate had his birthday barbecue on the 14th, and on the morning of the 15th at 6 o'clock in the morning, no. I was zooming into New Zealand. It was like, what did I do myself? Why do I do this to myself? I'm so hungover.
That's amazing. Yeah. That sounds wretched, but wonderful. And I'm sure it is really worth it.
So funny. So it's been great being able to interact with poets from around the world. And yeah, I think the common humanity is something which comes through a lot when you start hearing similar stories from all over the world, realize that everyone's going through the same shit.
Yeah, yeah. It's something really special that unites us. Have you got a poem that you'd like to share with us and maybe, you know, drum up some audience members for your tour?
I would like to share a poem which I wrote in May of last year. I have to give a trigger warning for state violence. First time I performed it, I didn't, and then afterwards somebody said that actually it's quite I'll do that.
Thank you.
And this is Stressor. Coming to mind, the stress module on my undergraduate psychology course. How I thought it would be all about mindfulness and management, but then how we spent 6 months learning how systemic oppression and structural inequalities can, over enough time, rewrite internal organs and shorten lives. Stress hormones, although having adaptive significance, have no place in this modern society because in its repeating stressful situations, cortisol, epinephrine, and norepinephrine, the flight and flight mechanisms bubbling within, availability of blood sugar, increasing heart rates, alertness stimulating synapses and muscle fibers, increasing respiration, supercharging digestion, all these natural responses are often read and misread as escalations. Joy Gardner, 1993. No one ever tells you that when it's your turn, stress hormones will burn through you like a wildfire. Blinding lights in tunnel vision, hypervigilance collapsing in under its own weight into an express train of thought, fixating on one track minutiae, devilish details like taser on the left, pistol on the right. Are they clipped in? Can I reach them when we fight? No one ever tells you that flashing before your eyes, words will lose all meaning as time unwinds, set to spinning by hopes and dreams and memories overlapping and receding, retreating before the flood. A tsunami of rushing blood is shelling in your ears, jungle drumming a warning, and all of this will be so loud you will sink into it and drown. Azel Rodney and John Charles de Menezes, 2005. No one ever tells you that when it's your turn, stress hormones will churn up the bottled demons of a lifetime, but that when you are the star, local aunties will form a protective ring, filming on their phones, circling in Celsius, summoning crows at a murder maybe, mouth-shaped O in a goldfish bowl where forgetfulness is contagious. Now, what was I thinking? What did he say? What did I put in my bag today? No one ever tells you words lose all meaning as time unwinds, scepter spinning, how the urge to struggle free is hardwired, how so much effort, so much presence of mind is required to not fight, to not fly, when so much pressure is applied. Daly and Atkinson, 2016. No one ever tells you that when it is your turn, stress hormones will surge into boiling emotions, clouds of explosives seeking a spark. Did Taser Cop, the young looking one, just call me son? Was he even born when Daly and Atkinson scored that goal of the season to the soundtrack of The Lightning Seeds? Am I allowed to be this angry? Is this angry safe for me? No one ever tells you in life flashing before your eyes that words will lose all meaning as time unwinds in bubbling blood sugar, heart rate increasing, alertness stimulating, respiration increasing, digestion supercharging, synapses, everything set to spinning. And no one ever tells you that focusing on your breathing only helps when you can breathe. It's the first anniversary of George Floyd being murdered for an alleged misdemeanor. They blindside me, pin me, I'm pinched like vice. And I don't know how, and I don't know why, but stress hormones raging. I remember to comply.
Wow. That's not the first time I've heard you read that poem, and I've still got chills. It's so powerful.
Yeah, it's a true story. So there you go.
I hadn't planned on asking any more questions, but if you'd like to discuss that poem.
I think the thing for me is that the poem is, it's just about the fact that no one ever, I think the thing for me is that when you're marginalized, when you're othered, that people don't often understand your anxieties or where they come from. And I think that poem came about because I became absolutely determined to explain to a friend of mine just quite soon after that had actually happened, why being a black man in London makes you a little bit apprehensive of the police. And I was, that was simply it. I wanted to explain to somebody what it is it's simply because you don't, until you go through experiences like that, and when you have experiences like that, until you've gone through them, police are on your side. You know, you see the police are on my side. I'm a law-abiding citizen, they're on my side. But there are certain people whose experience is that the police are not on their side. It doesn't matter what they're doing or what they've done. And that provides for a certain level of anxiety. So I wanted to get that point across. And I think, hopefully I did. And I think it's something which we can translate into other people being anxious around for other reasons. It's simply because the world doesn't see them the way that you think they do.
Absolutely. I mean, I am not a black man. I do live in London, but I'm not black. And so I don't know what that feeling of being targeted, of being seen automatically as somebody that can be treated differently because of the color of my skin. I don't have police prejudice against me, but as you say through your poem, it feels like, at least, okay, I haven't experienced it, but at least I can get a little bit of an insight into what you're feeling or someone else is feeling. And it goes back to, how are you, and how do you answer that question honestly? Because the other person will never know, because we can only experience who we are. But through your creation of a poem, you are giving someone a little window into what it's like to be someone else.
Yeah, and I think this is also over the pandemic with the Sarah Everard murder vigil, police action, all of those sorts of things. I actually live 20 minutes from Clapham Common, 20 minutes walk from Clapham Common. And the again, it was that thing of I got into it on social media. Oh my God, there seems to be quite a lot of this. I got into it on social media with somebody who while the vigil was happening, I didn't go down myself because being clinically vulnerable, I was still avoiding crowds. But I was keeping an eye on it on social media, and when it all kicked off, I was trying to get a male friend of mine from university to stop trying to center his voice in the conversation that was happening. And I told him politely a couple of times that if he had an opinion, he was free to share it on his own wall, but he wasn't free to share it where female friends of mine who live in the area were saying things. Mm. And I ended up having to police my post about Sarah Everard Vigil by sort of, in the end, I ended up blocking him. I ended up blocking someone I've been friends with for 20 years because it was that thing of, he wasn't taking the hint. Mm. You can't tell my friend Rebecca that lives 10 minutes down the road that she should be feeling a certain way about the way the police are behaving. You can't. Not now. Yeah. It's not your time. Shush.
Yeah.
And I think it's that thing I was trying to... It's that thing... I don't think he was capable of putting himself into the position that women were feeling about police action at that point. Whereas my experiences as a black man dealing with the police I've had it really easy to put myself into the shoes of what the women were feeling at the time, because it's something which I felt previously. I think that, it was illuminating, I think.
Yeah. No, I had a similar experience with BLM. In that I spent many hours trying to explain to people that you shouldn't be angry at people for protesting a huge injustice that they have had to deal with for their entire lives. And people just wouldn't really understand. And same as you, people that I've known for 15 years, you do all you can and you can't get through because they're just not willing to put themselves and their personal fears aside and look at it from someone else's point of view.
Yeah, I think that's the key to empathy, I think, is to ask yourself, what are they afraid of? I think a lot of people just, they don't value other people's fears. And I think that makes it very difficult to get through to them.
Mm. But then you have these wonderful things where you see people from one community supporting those in another community because, as you say, they've experienced not the same thing, but perhaps a similar thing, which is, it's really beautiful.
Yes. Actually. And I think that, I remember one... Sorry, I just had this thought. I remember once saying to an HR person that I was the ultimate diversity hire because I was queer, disabled, and black. And it's interesting because the different communities that I have been a part of in that Venn diagram are really starting to show some solidarity, and it's quite a beautiful thing to see.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's the same for, I think, people who are raised female and non-binary folk as well. And I actually got that at a gig recently as well. Someone was like, wow, you're disabled, pansexual and non-binary. And I was like, yeah, but it's I mean, it is what it is. Like, let's face it. Like we've all got something that someone's going to hold against us. And I think the more we support each other and appeal to people's like common humanity, common kindness, common fears as well, as you say, like you're just trying to, everybody at the end of the day wants to have security, a place to sleep, warmth and love, don't they? And so I think if you try and find what links us, that's always going to be more powerful than the fears that seek to drive us apart.
Well, you'd hope so. I think.
Yeah, I mean, fingers crossed.
Well, you know, it's kind of our responsibility as artists to to inspire people to hold that, to hope that is true. You know, it's some of the best. Although, actually, sorry, just to completely weird segue. but the thing which drives me absolutely insane about humanity is, no matter how many times a science fiction writer tells humanity robots are a bad idea, and you know there's a history of them, you know, from Capek, Asimov, HAL, you know, basically artificial intelligence will destroy us. No matter how much we tell them that as writers and artists and show exactly how it's going to go wrong, you then watch a video of dancing robots and you think, really?
Oh, come on, Rick. Resistance is futile.
Really? So maybe we're not being so effective. But yeah, hopefully artists will, you know, it's that. Hopefully artists will be able to inspire people to a better world just without robots.
I think you're right, and I think it's a slow process, and it's very much kind of like affecting the individuals, and then eventually we'll get the whole web covered. But it's the individuals in society are one thing, and to influence their opinion, and then it's kind of getting it to trickle up to the elite and to and to the capitalists in charge, let's face it.
Yeah, I think the difficulty is, and this is going back to the anti-capitalist side of me, the difficulty is that capital's only loyalty is to other capital. So, you know, and if you're born into a world where, you know, and you have no capital, the only thing you can sell is your body.
Oh my God, I read that quote recently as well. And I was like, oh fuck, as a disabled person, that really hit me hard.
Yes. And exactly that. And I was about to say, as a disabled person, you can't get as good a price for your body as other people. Mm. So while capitalism is as it is, disabled people will always be left behind because they're not valued because their capital isn't as high.
Yeah.
That's just the truth of it. And I think, until we get to a world in which those first two levels of Maslow's hierarchy that you were talking about, the shelter, security, you know, food security, shelter and safety, until those two levels are provided for everyone, regardless of who you are, you're born into this world, you get those two levels. Until we get there, those people who can't sell their bodies for enough will always be at the bottom. That's just the way of it. So we have to flip the turtle. We have to just change everything. We have,
exactly. Take humanity as a whole from surviving to thriving as a disabled person who is also a survivor, and many, many other wonderful experiences I've had in my life, they said sarcastically. I've often really struggled to get even the base levels of Maslow's hierarchy. And so it's only really in recent years where I've been able to turn to creativity, to try and inspire change in others, to try and, you know, gradually get this ball rolling as well. And I think you're 100% right. It is the job of the artist, and you're doing exactly that, which is wonderful. So thank you so much for putting your art out into the world.
I don't know how to respond to that. Yeah, I guess. Well, you're welcome. I don't know, but it's not like I have a choice. You know, it's that thing of artists is more a vocation than a job. You suddenly realise that this is what you're meant to do, and you can't do anything else. So
bring forth what is within you, or it will destroy you. That's definitely what art feels like to me.
No, absolutely. Spot on. That's the one.
Rick, it's been so wonderful to get to chat to you. Thank you so much. And I will put all the links for your...
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
I'll put all the links for your website, social media handles. Audience listening now, you will be able to find the details of Rick's tour on the description for this podcast. So do go and check him out because he's an incredible performer live as well.
Thank you for listening to A.G. Parker's Cabinet of Curiosities. Tune in next month when I'll have another guest on the show. Until then, stay curious.